Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
And good Monday, everybody. Welcome into Darren, Donick, and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're streaming all around the world on the Game Nashville app. Chase McCabe, Willie Donick, hanging out with you. Darren McFarland on vacation this week. And Willie, you're at your home studio, but guess where I'm at?
It sounds like you might be at the home base.
I am at the home base. I am at the Wholesale Link Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. The place looks the same. Nothing really has changed. Looks nice. Good to see Marquise.
Nice and clean.
Nice and clean. A lot of hand sanitizer, a lot of all-purpose cleaner. So we're keeping the place nice and neat. And so, yeah, I decided to come in. Ryan's out this week, so I'm having to do a little bit extra. Decided to come in today. Saw Dagwood from 102.9 The Buzz. So it's good to be here. And I'll tell you this. I know that we all haven't been out and about a lot in the last 3.5 months, but three lanes on 440, that is getting it done. I was a big fan of that.
Nice. That is very nice to hear. That is, it's almost too good to be true. Like we're so used to it not being like that. Like I don't know what I'm going to do when I first go down that road. I haven't yet.
Yeah, it's cool, and they got it done early. I think there's still some things they're working on, but all three lanes in both directions are open, so it made the drive in this morning a lot easier. Obviously not as much traffic with people still working from home, and for the most part, I mean, that's what we're doing. I'll be back at the home studio tomorrow, but it was cool to have that drive in this morning and then do the rundown from here and just sitting in the studio, got both TVs going, so it's kind of nice. Kind of nice to be back. It's been a while, and you don't realize how much you appreciate something until you don't have it anymore.
Well, no question about it. And so excited to roll on here. I meanwhile, at my home studio, I had to move my cat, Stanley, who thought he was hosting the show today.
Oh, Stanley was ready.
I had to slide him over to the couch. Yeah, he was ready to host. I got, you know, I was setting things up, you know, like 30 minutes ago. He was prepped. He was ready to go. I had the computer, the microphone, everything was all hooked up, and he was sitting in my chair.
We just need to have
the video on there, and I was...
Have Stanley and Nash co-host one day. That's what needs to happen. Even though Nash doesn't have a whole lot to say.
Stanley and Nash, I think that would be there would be no wasted words. That's for sure. Stanley and Nash together on the show.
It's also good to be back here with you guys. Had fun filling in with Floyd last week, but with Jared out, you know, having to shift a few things around, so got to hang out with the GM and pick his brain. I don't know if you heard on Friday, but we kind of hit on something that I know people were talking about on Twitter. But I had asked him, you know, in his career, there is, because Vince Carter retired from the NBA, is there a player that he wished the end of their career had been different, that, you know, and I was asking more of just a fan standpoint. And of course he said, well, it's a very easy answer for me. It's Steve McNair. And he started talking about how his time here ended with the Titans, and that the plan had always been for them to draft Vince and have Steve mentor Vince. And unfortunately it didn't work out that way, but he told the story of that day that he walks into Bud Adams' office and he says, hey, you'll be happy to know that your quarterback's here today working out. And Bud looks at him and says, well, if he gets hurt, do we have to pay him? And Floyd said, well, yeah, but he's just by himself. He's just out running some drills, and he looks good, and he's going to be ready to go. And that's when, of course, we know what happened, that they had to tell Steve to go home because they didn't want him to get hurt. They had to rework the contract. And as history showed us, it ended up not being a good thing because they had to trade him, and he moved on to Baltimore. But I had never had that conversation with Floyd before. And so that was interesting and neat to hear him talk about it. And obviously, he wishes things went differently.
Well, that whole thing, that was very, very tough. I remember at the time when Floyd was doing his weekly show with us, how regretful he was even then, you know, and trying to explain all of the reasons why they did what they did. And of course, it just didn't make sense to anybody. Nobody could understand that part of it. It was a ridiculous amount of money that they would have had to pay him, right? It's not just they would have had to pay
him. Sure.
He had a clause in his contract that guaranteed him a gigantic number. So it was going to be hard enough to make that work. The Vince Young with Steve McNair, the mentor, the placeholder, which sounded great. But it was definitely a tough way to end it. I thought they did a very good job being able to get a draft pick for Steve McNair, who had, as it turned out, one more productive season left in him before he started to decline. He was already showing a lot of physical decline already. You know, the injuries were just piling up so much. The team around him was in the rebuild. So it was a tough time. And I think Floyd did a tremendous job resetting the table after they had to clear the decks and they had to make those very tough decisions that people really don't do as much anymore. But back then it was much more customary that you maxed out the credit card, then you blew it up, right? Started from scratch and then built it back up, and it would take a year or two. For a year or two, they had about the youngest team you could have around Steve McNair, and they suffered bad, and Steve McNair took a beating. And I'm not sure that it would have worked real well to have Steve McNair mentoring Vince Young. I don't know how well that would have worked.
Well, I don't know.
Maybe it would have, but it would have been a tough call, right, to all of a sudden tell Steve McNair it's time to step aside for Vince Young. I mean, we know what a competitor Steve McNair was. So, but all in all, I think if you look after Floyd was let go, he had left the table pretty full for the surge that ended up being, you know, some nice seasons in 2007 and 2008.
I feel like if they had been able to rework the contract, which according to Floyd at one time, Steve was willing to do that. If they were able to rework the contract, then it could have worked, and you might have seen a difference in Vince Young. That Vince Young, if he had had a year, even if it was just a year, to back up Steve McNair and learn from Steve, who's somebody that he respected and liked a lot, they had a very good relationship, that if they had had that time, then you could have seen a different Vince Young. He would have learned some things that would have helped him mature, and some of the ways that his career ended with the Titans may never have happened, but we'll never know. I mean, it's one of those you can look back on and talk about and say, well, what if this happened and what if this happened? Truthfully, we will never know how it turned out. But it was just obviously an interesting moment for me and a fun moment for me to listen to Floyd talk about that and ask him some questions about those times.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was it ended up being Floyd's last year
yep.
as the general manager. And you know, that was, as I said, you know, a tough 3 years, right, where he was reworking it. But if you look, he really was setting and laying the groundwork for the resurgence of the team with guys like David Thornton and Chris Hope, Kyle Vandenbosch, you know, the right veteran guys to sort of rebuild. Kevin Mawai was in that group, right? He had to have the right free agents and then build back through the draft. And I don't know if they hit the jackpot in the draft. I just wonder how well that dynamic would have worked with McNair and with Vince Young and the cap space that went with that, right? Because
sure.
Vince Young back then, you had to sign the rookie to the bigger deal, right? You had to invest a lot of money up front, more so than you do today. And Steve McNair he would have had to rework his contract, right? I know that was the plan, but that was going to be a difficult thing. And so all things considered, I'm like you. I would have loved to have seen it if everybody could have been on board with it, but I'm not sure it would have been that smooth. And I don't think it was the worst possible outcome. Now, the unfortunate thing at the training camp, that's what Floyd, I think, really regrets the most,
yeah.
As I've heard him talk about it, just the, you know, not even being able to go in there and work, telling a guy you can't come in, basically you're home away from home for the last however many years. You know, that was ridiculous. And it's just, you know, those were strange rules back then. but those were the rules. And so Floyd had no choice but to react. But that was definitely a tough way to end it.
I know that we're going to talk to Chris Broussard from FS1 later on in the show, but you had a chance to watch the decision documentary that was on last night on ESPN. Marquise and I talked a little bit about it earlier on the rundown, but what did you think about the piece?
Well, we had an outstanding interview, Marquise can tell you, with Don Van Natta last week. And so I was prepped, right? I was excited to watch it because he laid the groundwork with Darren and I when we were chatting with him about it. It was a fascinating piece for sure. I remembered it. I was actually on the air. We were doing a radiothon deep into the night when it was going on. So I didn't watch it live. We were monitoring. We weren't even in a place. We were on site at a place that didn't have any TVs or anything. So we were following it as best we could on the internet and things like that. But I'll always remember where I was when that happened. But I thought ESPN did an excellent job with the backstory, telling about all the different elements and the big concept, I think, going forward, and that is how journalism is done these days, the different layers of journalism, how it evolves, especially with newspapers not the same as they used to be, the weekly magazines like Sports Illustrated not the same as it was, sports talk radio is evolving. Right. But you also have this whole wave, and that kind of started it, right, of athletes taking control of the power they had and telling their own story. Things like the Players Tribune, all the different outlets that LeBron James is using now to tell his own story. But I think it's important to know that that's a good thing, right? Athletes being able to tell their own story, but old school journalism, let's call it that, is also very important, right? The two have to balance each other out. The two viewpoints are both extremely important.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, I think, too, what's interesting to see is how LeBron has, you know, has evolved from it, because he took a lot of heat after that, and rightfully so. I think the intentions were good, but how it came off was not good. It seemed he came off self-centered for it, and I know that's not how he meant it. That's just how it came off. And so, you know, going back to Cleveland and winning a championship and what he had to do there and how he kind of made up for it, and I guess some people might put it right at some wrongs, but just all the aftermath of that one special and how we still talk about it some 10 years later.
But it's crazy because that was the blueprint of what we have from LeBron now, with the uninterrupted and more than an athlete and all that media, because he fired a lot of his guys after the fact. So once he fired his agent, you know, Rich Paul stepped in and he got a bigger role. You know, he fired another guy and then Maverick Carter got a bigger role. So and those guys built an empire based off of basically that decision. LeBron could probably still have the same agent if it wasn't for that situation. So, you know, it helped him build this mega media company in the uninterrupted, and, you know, doing these different things as an athlete. And so maybe he had to burn for that, you know, the decision in order for us to have all that other stuff.
But he learned from it. I think that was another thing that was clear about it. He did not prepare. He didn't have the right people that maybe alerted him. LeBron, we've got to think about how you're going to do this, how this is going to come across. He clearly did not do that. And then the aftermath, he goes through this, and I think this is what is admirable about LeBron. He said, okay, how do I learn from this? I think he's done a great job of evolving and being very thoughtful for how he presents himself. I remember being really disappointed. You know, I've got a lot of family that lives in Ohio, and they are diehard Cleveland fans. And so I felt bad for them, you know, the whole Believe Land thing. And so I was excited when he came back. But I did go through a time where I wasn't rooting for LeBron. I didn't like the whole concept of the super team, you know, right or wrong. And, you know, athletes being able to use their muscle and influence to kind of create these super teams. That's been a trend that has happened as a result of this. Although the Big Three, I guess, had been put together a few years before that. That was really the first time, when the Celtics got Garnett,
right,
Pierce, and why am I not? Ray Allen. Yeah. So those were the three that united and won a title in Boston. So that was already starting to happen. But I didn't like that, right? It just like the Warriors became a team that didn't really have a lot of appeal after Kevin Durant joined them, right? So LeBron went through that fire for sure, and then he became the lovable, older vet underdog that everybody seemed to be rooting for again with Cleveland. So it's really interesting to watch the evolution of how this has happened and how LeBron has gone through it.
Yeah, and I don't think, to be honest with you, I don't think LeBron wins a championship in Cleveland if he doesn't go to Miami. Like, Miami to him was the learning experience. He had to get the burden of having to win a championship off his shoulders, and then that brought him back to Cleveland and that championship experience that he already had, and you know, teaching those young guys like Kyrie Irving and Tristan Thompson to eventually win a championship in Cleveland. So, you know, maybe he did have, and they talked about that in the documentary, maybe he had to leave Cleveland in order to, you know, find himself as a player and get better as a player and then go back to Cleveland and win a championship. So it's storybook at the end of it.
When we come back, Willie, we're going to talk.
Great story.
Yeah, absolutely. When we come back, we're going to talk to Vince Ferrari. Usually he joins us at noon on Mondays, but he's got midday duties this week in Knoxville. So we're going to talk to him about all things Vols when we come back. Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Chase McCabe, Willie Donick here with you at the WholesaleLink Studios powered by RumbleOn.com. At least I am. Usually at noon on Mondays, we talk to Vince Ferrara from the Sports Animal WNML in Knoxville, but he's got some hosting duties, so we say hello to him right now. Vinny, what's going on, my friend?
Guys, how we doing?
We're hanging in. We're doing good. We're doing doing well today. As we talk some Vols with you, I want to get your opinions because I know that Phil Fulmer has done some various interviews, and he's given his thoughts on this, but basically saying that they are preparing, at least like they're going to have all of their fans. They're going to be at full capacity at Neyland Stadium because they can then scale back if they need to. It's easier to plan like you're going to have everybody there and then dial it back. So what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that there is a chance that they have a full Neyland Stadium at some point this fall, or do you feel like the rest of us in that it's probably going to be not full capacity?
Well, the way you phrased it there, Chase, probably not is the camp I would be in right now. It's hard to speak in definites or exclusives right now because this is changing. Unfortunately, in a lot of places, it's going the wrong direction. And maybe that can turn back at some point, hopefully so. But it is a little bit more concerning now than it was. Philip Fulmer, one of the times he said that was on our afternoon show, I guess it was about a week and a half ago. Every day passes, and there's more and more reports of positive tests around the country. Football, really haven't heard much since those guys first got on campus. I think the numbers haven't been, in terms of colleges and especially at Tennessee, have slowed since the players have been on campus. And I think they are doing follow-up testing on campus. So that is a positive that we're not hearing about more positive tests when you're doing the follow-ups once they initially came in on campus for workouts. So that means that for the most part, kids on campus are doing the right thing. I think that's going to be a big part of it is what does each school do with its players being responsible, and then what's the local area looking like? And look, there's worse areas than Knoxville for sure. I'm still skeptical that they're going to be able to have a full stadium, but I also don't blame them for having that as a plan. Not one that's concrete, but one that they are riding with until they are forced to alter it, because they are preparing for with other plans for lesser percentages of the fans in the stadium. I think it just depends on how the student athletes handle it and how the fans and the students on campus handle things leading up to it. And then obviously what the local administrators say in terms of reopening in Knoxville, Knox County, and in the state as well. So I think they have all those scenarios. I think Phil Fulmer is just trying to be positive, and then also, hey, feel free to get some season tickets. And if you don't, then we can put it towards next year, or, you know, or get your money back at some point. I still think that's, for them, the better business play and the more hopeful, positive business play, as opposed to overreacting and then trying to pull it back when, if and when things do improve.
Okay, that's my only COVID-related question for you today, because I actually want to talk some football about the Vols. So you and I do a lot of the same things in that we read and we hear everything, and as it's related to this football team. And one thing that I thought was interesting is I've seen a few people say that this is the last year, or should be the last year, that the Vols aren't considered to be one of the contenders in the SEC. Now, we've also had the conversation, Vince, about, well, last year, you know, they overachieved, especially how they started the year. Everybody was ready to fire Jeremy Pruitt after the first few weeks of the season. I know we had that discussion. But then it became, okay, now they look good. They've had a good recruiting class, even though a lot of that's not going to help them until next season. So what are the realistic expectations when you read the polls that have the Vols in different spots and have them maybe achieving different things this season, as opposed to, okay, next year and beyond, they're going to be contenders in the SEC?
I do think, Chase, that if this season goes well with a positive direction for Jeremy Pruitt and the program, say they get to 8 regular season wins, which is where I would have them right now at 8-4. And then, you know, if you win a 9th game in a bowl game, Tennessee's been good in recent bowl appearances, that, you know, you go from 8 wins to 9 wins, and maybe Harrison Bailey is ready to take over a quarterback. Maybe you've been at fans or reporters around the country. Maybe they got a little bit of a sampling of Harrison Bailey this year and saw some promise in him, and then you think, all right, this team can take that next step next year. They may have that special quarterback that Tennessee has been looking for a long time, to go with a competent defense. The last time they had a prolific quarterback, the last two times they've had a prolific quarterback, Joshua Dobbs and Tyler Bray, two very different guys, but they also had awful defenses for some of those years that those guys played. That probably won't be the case if Harrison Bailey is that special quarterback next year. They'll have a good defense to accompany with. So I do think the expectations are going to be greater next year. Will some people say this is the year where they contend? I think that's going to be maybe more so the fans that are really optimistic and ready to buy in and have higher expectations than maybe, you know, some of us in the media. But then I also think there'll be some that say, hey, this is the team to watch for. You'll see more of the, as we get closer to season, Tennessee is going to be one of those air quote sleeper teams to look for if you're trying to pick somebody different other than Florida and Georgia. But I still think most people are going to go Florida, Georgia. Most people have in those preseason publications I've seen. But there is variance, Chase. It's in those polls that you mentioned. I've seen Tennessee in the lower end of the teens. And I've seen Tennessee not even in the top 25. I think one of them, it might have been Lindy's, one of the publications had them, if you counted the receiving votes, to be 31. So that's a pretty big range from, you know, 18, 19 to 31. I would, to me, I think Tennessee is in that early 20s-ish, maybe late teens, somewhere in there. I think that's the 8-4 range for Tennessee, and that's where I would have them. But there is one win plus, one win minus. I think there is a little bit of a variance, and it's probably because of the unknown of the quarterback.
Yeah, and that's the question that once that's answered, you might give people a clearer picture. I mean, you're still going to have those fans that go, oh, no, you know, after last year, it's just, you know, in my mind, it's going to get better. So they're going to go from 9 to 10, and, you know, hey, they could be in the SEC championship game. You're going to have those people. Mm-hmm. I just think you have to be realistic. And I lied. I said I wasn't going to bring COVID up again. You do have to factor it in, because the schedule could change. You could lose some players because they test positive. There are a lot of outside factors that, you know, 6 months ago we didn't think we were going to have to talk about, and now we are. So you have to take that into consideration. But if you look at their schedule, to me, Vince, and I believe we've had this discussion before, at Oklahoma in week two and then the game in Knoxville against Florida, those could potentially be season-defining games for this team. However those games shake out could really determine how they're going to go and what they're going to do moving forward this season.
And if you have hopes to spoil the party, the Florida-Georgia party in the East, getting one of those two games at least, maybe even a second one, which would be if they beat Florida and Georgia, they're absolutely in it. Because then you're talking tiebreakers as well. But that's the one that carries even more weight within not only the conference, but within the division. Plus you get Florida at home. It's a week after you play Furman, so there aren't going to be excuses in terms of who you played the week before being difficult. That's one of the pluses of Tennessee's schedule, is their tough games are all spaced out. You got Charlotte before Oklahoma. You have Furman before Florida. You have an open week before Alabama, and you have Kentucky before Georgia. So things are spread out. There's not that middle gauntlet. When you play Oklahoma, what's Spencer Rattler, if he's the one that in fact wins that job? He's a former five-star, good chance he's going to be special, but is he special out of the gate, or is he going to need a few weeks into the season for him to be special? Well, you play Oklahoma in week two. They still have a ton of talent, though, so there's obviously that unknown there. So I think there's some opportunities there that there's fans that want to talk themselves into best case scenario. You can make those cases for sure. Even when you play Alabama, you can talk yourself into, hey, that's Alabama's eighth consecutive game out of the gate if the schedule stays the same. Tennessee has an open week before Alabama, played them tough last year. So there's things you can talk yourself into without a doubt. If they don't get much improved quarterback play, if it's like last year, those things aren't going to happen. If you get special quarterback play, or if you get improved, more consistent quarterback play, Garantano or Harrison Bailey, then some of those other things can happen. But those are guesses right now. But Garantano is going to get the first shot, though, with the second year under Jim Chang.
The word potential gets a lot of coaches fired. And you look at the freshmen, the young players coming into this team, and you see a lot of potential. You mentioned Harrison Bailey quite a bit, and he falls into that category. But the young players, the freshmen and other young players that could have an impact and should have an impact on this team, who would you say?
Well, we did a poll on our website. We put all of the 23 incoming freshmen on our website and let people vote. No one was left out. And it wasn't even close. It was the fans are all not all voting for, but the runaway leader was Harrison Bailey, because a lot of fans want him to play, five-star quarterback, and there's the hopes that he's going to play and be special out of the gate. And look, it's happened. Jake Fromm got to the national championship game as a freshman quarterback. So I'm not saying he's Jake Fromm, but he's highly rated as well. It can happen. The odds aren't in your favor that it will. So that's the guy that will be the first one that fans will talk about. I think the more realistic ones are a couple on defense and then at wide receiver. On defense, to me, my favorite player in this class, my favorite player in last year's class was Henry Toto, who was a freshman All-American and will likely be at least All-SEC this year. He is that special. But to me, the special guy of this class is freshman Keyshawn Lawrence. His long-term position is probably cornerback, but he can play anywhere in the secondary. Great size, Pruitt type of size. Guys that are big, can run, and have ball skills. 6'2", 202. Love that if you're a corner. He could play nickel. He could play safety. There's opportunity. Second corner opposite Bryce Thompson is not a lockdown by any means. Nickel is a position you can move some guys around and open that up. Second, the other safety spot opposite Jalen McCullough, who had a terrific freshman year and became a starter in the second half of the year, that those positions are there. He's a guy that said, they can play me anywhere. I want to play. I think Pruitt will find a role for him, and I think he is going to be, to me, the biggest impact freshman when you look back on the 2020 season. There's other guys from opportunity. Mentioned others on defense and outside linebacker slash defensive end, those rush positions. There's replacing Daryl Taylor. You need to get after the quarterback. And a couple of the guys, Morvin Joseph, Tyler Barron, are two that come to mind that are big and physical enough to be able to jump right into the SEC. And then there's a need position there where I think they can upgrade, maybe not starting out of the gate, but have a role and have that expand as the year goes on. And then the other an opportunity is that wide receiver. And there's a bunch of them. They have four-star freshman wide receivers. To me, the guy that I think will have the best chance to make an impact early is Jalin Hyatt. He's from South Carolina. He's the thinnest, the slenderest of all those receivers. But, man, he can run after the catch, has great jumping ability as well. And Tennessee needs that speed and explosiveness that continued to add on in recruiting after that. But this class really brings that at the wide receiver position. They have, like I said, any of those four could probably do it. But there's a need at wide receiver, and I would expect one or two at least to be really key contributors as freshmen. There's others, but those are the ones that I think would be at the top of the list for impact freshmen in 2020 for Tennessee.
We're talking to Vince Ferrara. Vince, one thing that comes to mind is you guys have the discussion about the schedule. If there are no fans or limited fans in the stands, presuming you can play the games, what factor do you think it is about playing on the road in these circumstances? How much of a home field advantage does a team lose in this case? So I just wonder, you know, a lot of times this in our minds, you're saying, well, it's going to be tough to win at Alabama or at Georgia, wherever the game might be, hostile atmosphere. I just wonder, will there be more road upsets this year if they can play these games under these circumstances? Because it's just a little bit more of it's just going to be a different environment.
I think that's an excellent point, and it's one that I could see happening to some degree. I still tend to just favor the better team more often than not when you're just picking them, and I take that approach home or road, better team. Now, when it's close, then typically you would go with the team that has that home field advantage, and fans play a big part in that. So maybe in some of those closer to 50-50 type of games, it would nullify them from that home team having that typical advantage. So yeah, I could see there being more road upsets. Just depends on how evenly matched those are. I don't know that it's going to be a drastic thing, but you didn't mean that anyway. I could see an uptick in those road wins. And, you know, what's that road team like? Are they a team like Tennessee that's experienced, that has 25 seniors, and I think it's 14 more juniors, a lot of upperclassmen? That's the kind of team that could probably get some things done on the road, because they have players that have already dealt with those loud environments. Now they don't have to do as many silent counts at the line of scrimmage. The quarterback,
right,
the offense can communicate more, those kind of things. So, yeah, and more experience, besides just the experience, but the experienced quarterbacks, that should be an advantage. With Garantano, he would fall in that category. Problem is that at times early last year when he was getting benched, he would change plays into the wrong plays. Has he flushed that out? Is that something that he can still deal with the fan noise, to where if he's got to make an adjustment with a silent type account and just communication, can he get them into the right plays under those circumstances, or them not being as bad this time around? I don't know, but I think there are those type of teams that with experience could pull off even more of those upsets.
We know the landscape, as we've discussed from week to week, Vince, is going to change in college baseball with the changing landscape of minor league baseball in general. Tennessee got some significant players drafted a couple of weeks ago. Pretty exciting stuff for them. So where does that leave them for next year?
Well, all three of their draft picks are signed, are officially signed now. Crochet is a millionaire with the White Sox. Alex Solari, the second-round pick of the Twins, and then Zach Daniels, fourth-round pick with the Astros. So those guys are all officially gone. They had two free agent signees and two right-hand pitchers, Chase Wallace and Cody Davidson. They have a couple of guys in the transfer portal, not any more than anybody else, but none of them, all of them were role players or guys that didn't even play this past year. And then they had one of their senior catchers that had the ability to come back, Landon Gray, that's moved on from baseball. He had a number of athletes, I'm sure, had his next career job lined up, so he's not returning. And then he didn't have one transfer in from ETSU and catcher Jackson Greer. So you lose those guys, you add one transfer in, and you have a really, really good group of freshmen coming in, including a couple of elite arms, Blake Tidwell, who is from Loretto, Tennessee, and Charis Butcher, another strong-arm kid from IMG Academy, originally from Indiana. So, and they have other really good players they're adding to the mix, but you're adding a pretty good recruiting class to bringing back most of your team. Eight of your top nine hitters are back. You lose your top average guy in Zach Daniels, and the other eight are back. So you have the majority of your position players back with now some competition with freshmen and a few JUCOs. Your next guy, your 10th guy in average, is Alex Solari, who's a second-round pick. So you have a lot coming back, plenty of really quality arms, and Jackson Leith and Chad Davis, Sean Hunley, a number of other freshmen that didn't get a ton of innings this year but are talented arms that they think have bright futures, plus some of those special arms that, as freshmen, you can make immediate impact. So I think Tennessee is still in very good shape, going to have a very good year. And, right now you're seeing player development, Willie, with this team and this coaching staff. And I've compared Tony Vitello to Rick Barnes before, because you go through Rick Barnes' roster and you see improvement, 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 improvement. About the same, improvement, improvement, improvement. Maybe a step back, improvement, improvement. So in large part, most of the players get better under Rick Barnes. That's the case. Arm after arm after arm, position player after position player after position player. Guys get better under this coaching staff. And so you have all that coming back, talent coming in, plus just the trust factor of player development that's happening at Tennessee. I would expect them to be what they would have been this year, in my opinion, and that's an NCAA tournament team, and maybe – even on the cusp of competing to host a regional. We'll never know what step they would have taken this year, but college baseball is going to be so loaded. You know that, Willie, next year with talent coming in and talent being pushed back, it's going to be a fascinating year. So the competition is going to be fierce, like none we've ever seen. But I think Tennessee will be right in the mix of that.
That will be something to watch the next few years, is how much deeper all college rosters are and how that affects where high school kids want to go. Does that spread them out to more teams around the country? I'm also curious, in the short term, how many seniors in all of the spring sports have decided to take up the NCAA on coming back for their senior year, as opposed to what you said, some people saying, yeah, I could come back, but I'm ready to go.
I'm
just wondering what the numbers look like now that it's been a couple of months.
Yeah, Landon Gray is the only one that I've heard of. There may be others in some of the spring sports, the spring Olympic sports that I hadn't heard of, or maybe weren't as publicized. But Landon Gray was the one that made that decision not to return. Look, Tennessee has some other really good seniors, like Redmond Walsh, who was a stopper of the year candidate, who was a big time arm. He could have moved on, and there's others. So, Landon Graves is the only one, and at least the NCAA is giving them the opportunity to be able to spread those scholarships out more, and not have the 25% scholarship minimum, and they can spread it out and kind of rework those numbers. But by the way, Redmond Wash was a redshirt junior, but he could have moved on to pro baseball if he wanted to. Pete Durkay is another one that was a senior that I believe is coming back. So it's the tougher decisions, but at least they gave him a little bit of wiggle room to work around. And you mentioned maybe spreading out the talent in other areas, the transfer portal. I don't know if you've seen it on D1 baseball. They have a great transfer portal tracker on their website, and that thing seems to grow daily. And there's so many of them there. Obviously it's probably never been that busy, but some of the other smaller programs are closing their baseball programs. And maybe there isn't the money in some of those smaller conferences, some of those schools, to take somebody in. They may want to or normally have an opportunity, but with the financial strain on a lot of these schools, they just may not have the money to add to it and just have to, stay below the minimum, the maximum in their scholarship, and not even be at the 11.7 because of how tough the finances are. So there may not be those opportunities out there at the smaller level to get that playing time.
Vince, great stuff as always. Enjoy hosting this week, and we'll talk to you next Monday.
Yep, and if McFarland doesn't come back with a big-time, serious, savage tan, we have issues. So hopefully you guys will see that.
I saw a picture of him last night, and as pasty as he is, I think it's going to be more than tan.
Burnt and fried, yes. For sure. It's hot down here in the South. For sure.
Extra crispy, that's for sure. Vince, thanks as always.
All right, guys. Have a great week. Appreciate you.
Vince Ferrara, the Sports Animal, WNML in Knoxville. Willie, when we come back, somebody we both know very well was on Golic and Wingo this morning and has had a lot of thoughts on what's going on in his state. We'll tell you who we're talking about when we return. Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game on the Game Nashville app. Chase McCabe, Willie Donick here this week is Darren McFarland on vacation. Enjoyed our conversation with Vince Ferrara from the Sports Animal WNML in Knoxville. But Willie, as we have discussed, and I heard you and Darren still talk about a lot of this last week, and we've obviously gotten into it a lot, that student athletes seem to have more of a voice than ever. And obviously there are big issues in our country right now. Somebody we know quite well, Kermit Davis, spent a long time at MTSU, Middle Tennessee State, now the basketball coach at Ole Miss. I've heard him do various interviews. He was on Golic and Wingo. He's been on other ESPN programs today. As Mississippi has now decided to take the Confederate flag out of their state flag, which I think is a huge step. I have a lot of family in that state. You know, I've spent a lot of time in that state, and I know that there are various views on that flag, the Confederate battle flag. But it's a huge step, in my opinion, for them to take it out of the state flag, because you've had many student athletes both at Ole Miss and Mississippi State say that it needs to come out, and there were some that were even saying they weren't going to play until that happened. So I think that's a big moment in our country for them to make that ruling. And Kermit Davis, to give his thoughts on it, this is from Golic and Wingo this morning, Kermit Davis on the flag.
Yeah, Trey, it was a welcoming sight, you know, as a native Mississippian born and raised in the state, and to see, you know, young people, athletic administrations, our legislation, the House and Senate acted real quickly. So it was a great day for our state because everyone knew, we knew that we needed a flag to represent all of our citizens, we needed a flag to represent our students in state, out of state, a flag to represent our student athletes. And so it was, you know, we've all done some different things in college coaching that we've enjoyed, but I don't know if I've ever had a more gratifying day to be a small part of change in our state.
And along those lines, as you said, you were born and raised there, and neither at Mississippi State or Ole Miss, that flag hasn't flown there since, I think, 2015 or 2016. Why did this happen now, and why didn't this happen sooner?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mike. I think you just saw that, you know, legislation was a big part, but it's the power of athletics. And our commissioner, Greg Sankey, came out and took a position. You know, there was going to be no SEC regionals, no SEC championships in our state if the flag was flying. And then Mark Emmert with NCAA came out and said the same thing of NCAA regionals. And then Colin Hill came out, and then I think it was 46, you know, coaches and administrators. It was all the schools. It was Ole Miss State, Southern Miss, Jackson State, Mississippi Valley, Alcorn State, and others. So I do. I just think it's the power of our voice and what's going on in our country right now, but it was sure a welcoming change for all of us.
Kermit Davis on Golic and Wingo this morning on the state flag in Mississippi. And Willie, like I said, we know Kermit quite well and know what he's about. And I think he said it best. Having a flag that represents everyone in their state is what they're looking for.
No question. And I commend the swiftness of how they got it done. And he touched on a couple of the factors, Chase, that what happened here. You had the athletes speaking out, yes. You had the coaches for all of the universities in the state go in front of the state legislature and say, we want this out. It's time. As was pointed out during that little piece that we gave you, you know, the campuses have not been flying that flag for quite some time anyway. It's the last state that still had a mini version of the flag within the flag. So, you know, in many people's minds, like, what took you so long? But I think the thing that put it over the top to me, besides the impassioned words of Kermit Davis and a lot of the other coaches that spoke in front of the you know, the ones who govern that state, was the NCAA, right? I don't know that it would have happened that easily and that quickly without the NCAA saying, hey, if you want to have championships hosted in your state, then you got to make a change here. And so I think it was a great example, as Kermit just said, of the NCAA, you know, using their influence to get, in my opinion, the right thing done. So I think at the end of the day, they want to win, right? And the, yep, that was worth it. And hopefully, you know, the people that have been resistant to this come around to the fact that, you know, this is something that's so important to so many, right? Having a flag that, as you pointed out, you know, represents everybody and not just some.
Yeah, I just think we're seeing change, and change scares people. No matter what the change is, it always scares people. But change is a good thing in this situation, and that's where everybody, I believe, needs to be educated and listen and talk and just take a step back and realize, hey, you know what? This is going to be good for everyone, because that's what they're trying to represent. They're trying to represent every citizen of the state of Mississippi. And as we're, you know, the bigger picture is trying to represent, you know, every citizen in the United States. So I commend those coaches and those players, those student athletes for speaking out and trying to get a change in that state, and I think this is going to be better moving forward. So you're right about the NCAA, though. If the NCAA doesn't step in, I don't know if it happens as fast. I think it happens eventually, but I don't know if it happens as fast as it did.
Well, this is something that we've been discussing on a large scale. You know, what can come out of, you know, what has happened over the last few weeks with George Floyd, et cetera. I think we've already seen some examples. Engaging in the process is important, right? Everybody banding together to try to get something done, registering to vote, like Jeremy Pruitt, you know, I commend him. He's getting his players to register to vote, trying to get them to take some time to educate themselves on who candidates are that, you know, maybe they weren't paying as much attention to before. That's important, right? For everybody. Right. No matter what color you are, no matter what your background is, it's so important to vote. I mean, sometimes I think we lose sight of, you know, it's easy to sit back and say, well, what difference can I make? I don't care about any of this stuff, but get engaged in this. We've already seen some examples where fairly quickly, you know, some policies have been changed as a result. And there's a lot of other things that I think can be gotten to if you engage in the process some.
When we come back, Willie, we're going to talk to Teresa Walker. She covers all things sports for the AP. We'll get into some Titans and much, much more with her. When we come back, Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN, 102.5 The Game.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA. Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited. Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.